There we are. All right. I'm now officially starting because I've turned on the recorder. So would it be useful to have a very short course or maybe something without credit designed to teach people how to use these tools? Or are you better off doing what I do, which is teach yourself when you need it? Any feeling? No feeling. What? Sure. Suppose it was just something free. It was just something where the school said, you know, come in, you know, for an hour a week and we'll teach you this. Would that be worth doing? Would anybody actually want to do it? Or, I mean, I generally find I learn things better by just teaching myself instead of by that kind of class. But I don't know if other people feel that way. I think PowerPoint is sort of neat. I mean, I've been learning it just for doing these things. Clearly can do lots of fancier things than I do. Anyway, let me actually start by persuading this thing to stop. First we decided that it's frozen. No, there we go. All right, so let me go to where we were last time. And I explained about von Neumann's solution, and I told you about Nash equilibria and about the problem with Nash equilibria. So let's now run through quickly a summary of what we've done so far and then do a few more things and then go on to talk about risk and insurance and that stuff, which really shouldn't be in this chapter but is and should be somewhere. So subgame, different solution concepts. One of them is subgame perfect equilibrium. That's the one that's like decision theory where you just work right to left, cutting off whatever people wouldn't do and then making your decision knowing what they're going to do. And that's fine, except that it may not exist. And if it exists, it depends on people not being able to commit themselves. Otherwise, way back at step one, I tell you, look, when we get to that step, I'm not going to do what you think I'm going to do. I'm going to do the other thing. And because of that, you'd better do this. That was my kid throwing a tantrum story, which is a real-world example of that. Strict dominance is another solution concept. That's the, I would say, very rare situation where whatever you do, I should do X. Whatever I do, you should do Y. So I do X and you do Y. We're finished. That's prisoner's dilemma is an example of that. We then had the von Neumann solution to a two-player game where I did not give you any idea of how to find it. That would be a much more difficult question, but just as a definition of a solution, what does that do? It says, here is a strategy for each of you. If A plays his strategy, he will win at least $10, and B, by playing his strategy, can make sure that A never wins more than $10. So it's sometimes referred to as a mini-max or a saddle point, because it's the maximum for one, minimum for the other. All right. Then there's Nash equilibrium, which is a many-player game, and each person is doing the best thing, given what everybody else is doing. I discussed some problems with that. Let me give you very briefly, because I think it's interesting, though not very useful, von Neumann's attempt to solve many-player games. And what he did was to say, you can think of a many-player game in terms of the outcome, which would just be a list when the game is over, how much did each person win or lose. And in terms of dominance, where dominance means if my coalition, if the four of us playing this game together can make sure that we get a certain result and that's a result that we all do better under. We then call that result dominates a different result. We've got two different results. One of them is that each of us gets $20. Another one is that each of us gets $10 and each of them gets $20. If we, the people who benefit under the first one, can compel that first one instead of the second one to happen, then we say that the first one dominates the second, that it is preferred by a set of people who can get it, basically. And then von Neumann defined a solution as a collection of outcomes, a set of ways the game could turn out, such that every outcome that wasn't in that collection was dominated by someone in that collection. So every outcome not in the solution, there's some outcome in the solution such that the players who are better off under that outcome can make it happen. And on the other hand, none of the ones within the solution dominate each other. So that you can think of it sort of as a list of alternative outcomes such that there's some sense in which you'd like to say one of them is going to happen, although it's not a very strong sense. But let me give you an example which probably makes it easier than putting it abstractly. And this is a very, very simple three-player fixed-sum game, namely three-player majority vote. We have a dollar, and the rule is that it is divided among the three players by majority vote. If two players vote for an outcome, it happens. So it starts out that Ann and Bill, who get along pretty well, suggests a very simple rule, Ann gets 50 cents, Bill gets 50 cents, Charles gets nothing. Charles says, I think we can do better than that. I think that Ann, who's a really nice person, ought to get 60 cents, not 50 cents. And I should get the other 40%, and Bill should get nothing. And Bill says, well, I think I can do better than that. I think we should cut Ann out entirely. Why should she get 60 cents, and you and I should each get 50 cents? You will note that at each step of that, the new suggestion dominates the one before it. The new suggestion is preferred by a majority to the one before it, and a majority is what it takes to get an outcome to happen. So that suggests there's something odd and paradoxical about this game, because if you think about it for a while, you will see that any division at all is dominated by another division. Any division you can think of, whoever is losing out on that one can suggest that one of the winners of the other one get more, he get the rest, and the other winner be cut out, and that will always be command majority support. So von Neumann suggests as a possible solution to that, the set of outcomes 0.5.50, 0.5.5, 0.50, 0.5. So that's the set of outcomes. The dollar is split evenly between Ann and Bill. The odd dollar is split evenly between Ann and Charles. The dollar is split evenly between Bill and Charles. If you think about it, with a little effort, you can see that any division of the dollar other than one of those three is dominated by at least one of those three. And none of those three dominates the others, because each of them is preferred by one person, disliked by one person, and tied by one person. So that's a von Neumann solution, but it's not clear what it's good for. And in fact, if you think about it for a while, it turns out that there are a lot of other von Neumann solutions to the game. That is to say, there are other sets of outcomes that also have this characteristic. And I will leave it as an exercise for you, if it, such things amuse you, to try to think up another set of outcomes which has the characteristic that everything outside of it is dominated by at least one inside, and nothing inside dominates each other. So that's, I take in a sense, evidence of an attempt, but in my view, a failed attempt. Let me go into something else, which is much a less ambitious, but I think more useful attempt at answering some of these questions. And this is the idea from Thomas Schelling of what are sometimes called Schelling points or focal points. And Schelling starts out with the following story, which seems to have nothing at all to do with games. And the story is that you're a professor at Yale, I guess. I think it was Yale or Princeton, someplace close to New York. And you call in two students, and you say, I've got a puzzle for you. I'm going to have to talk to you separately. You go out, and I'll talk to the first one. The deal is, I'll give you kids $50 if you can manage to meet tomorrow in New York City at the same place at the same time with no communication between the two of you between now and then. First guy goes out, gives the same offer to the second guy, sends them off in opposite directions. Where do they meet and when do they meet? Noon is a good answer. The Empire State Building was my answer, but I discovered there is no such place. The Empire State Building has four separate observation decks on four sides of the building, so there is no single unique location defined.
Yeah, it's a small deck, you can walk around.
Well, I think the meet, they're supposed to come to the same place, not search for each other. Apparently the answer that they came up with was under the clock at Grand Central Station. But what are you looking for, both with regard to the time and the place?
Something that's more than mundane. So it's not going to be some, you know, regular brownstone in the middle of nowhere or like an alphabet soup. It has to be a landmark.
I don't think... Can somebody describe more precisely what you're looking for? We got to make sure we go to the same place. So what one characteristic does the place have to have?
We both know where it is.
That clearly you're going to need, but something more than that.
You both been there together?
No, maybe we may not even know each other.
It's an obvious place to go.
Well, there may be more than one obvious place. Why, if I'm right, is the Empire State Building the wrong answer? Because there's only one chance in four that you'll end up on the same observation deck. What are the chances, if you're going to under the clock in Grand Central Station, you'll end up under the same clock? There's only one clock, I gather, at least in the waiting room. What you're looking for is uniqueness. What you're looking for is an outcome that both parties see as unique so that they can converge on it. Right, that's at least the claim that I'm making. And you could think of the same thing. I've got an example which isn't in here, but that I've used, where you have a series of numbers. and the people who separately pick the same number. And that's an interesting one, because the answer depends a lot on who the people are. All right, let's suppose, for example, that the numbers include four, 16, 100, and 10. Take that case. Probably we're going to have some more numbers as well. Let's take that for a moment. If you're a mathematician or somebody who's used to numbers, what is the number there that is obviously unique? Very good. Why is it 10? Why are the others not unique?
It's not a square.
That's right. On the other hand, you could easily enough imagine somebody who wasn't used to thinking in those terms saying, well, 110 are similar. They both end in zero, right? And therefore, they aren't unique, and then looking for something else unique. So the basic point I'm making is that the existence of a focal point or a Schelling point is a subjective fact. It's a statement of how people organize the world, not sort of a statement about the world itself. You can imagine lots of other examples of this pattern where you're just trying to coordinate without communication. I think he has another example where you've got two people who have parachuted out of an airplane and are trying to rendezvous. And they have a map, but they've made no agreement in advance. What do? They look for some unique point, let's say where two rivers flow together, and they both go there, and each in the hope the other one will see that as unique. What does this have to do with game theory? In game theory, you often have cases where you're trying to coordinate, and the reason you can't communicate is that you can't, not that you can't talk to each other, but that neither of you has any reason to believe what the other ones say. So my standard example here is bank robbery. And we've gotten away, and we figure we've got at least 20 or 30 minutes before the cops are on our trail. And we got to divide the money and go in our different directions. And I say, look, you know, we got 100,000 bucks. I did most of the work. You get 35,000, I get 65,000. Seems like a reasonable division to me. And you say, what do you mean a reasonable division? I mean, you may have done most of the work, but I was the guy who was out there where we could have gotten shot. I should get 60,000. I'll let you have 40,000. This conversation could go on until the cops arrive, which is not a great idea. So what do we do instead? 50-50. Why do we do 50-50? Not because either of us thinks it's fair. We both agree that 50-50 is unfair. We just disagree about which direction it's unfair in. But 50-50 is the one division that we see as unique. And therefore, we see the choice as not 50-50 versus 51-49 versus 52-48, but as 50-50 versus bargaining among a range of alternatives. All right? And you can think of a variety of examples in which what actually happens, split the difference is sort of a standard rule, in which what actually happens is being driven by which among the available alternatives the players see as the unique alternative, because the costs of the bargaining and negotiation and argument themselves are high enough so you don't want to keep it up forever. But let me go back to my point that what's unique is a subjective fact. Because you could imagine in that same bank robbery that you say, let's have an even split, and I say, absolutely, an even split. I get $25,000, you get $25,000, my wife gets $25,000, and my kid who did some of the research for us gets $25,000. That's an even split, right? Same amount to everybody. Say, no. I did it, and your family did it. 50-50. 50,000 for me, 50,000, and you can decide how much the kid gets. All right. So in that case, and you can think of a lot of other cases like that, the way in which you design the problem, which you structure the problem, can affect what the unique outcome is. And that, I think, is of some importance if you imagine that you're actually setting up bargaining of some sort, because you would like to get both sides looking at the problem in the way that gives the outcome that you favor. And similarly, my next example down is the one where, yes, of course it's 50-50, but it's 50-50 of the net, because I was the guy who had to bribe the clerk, not 50-50 of the gross. And you say, we both had costs. You had to bribe the clerk. I had to buy a gun. The cost to me of the risk of being arrested is larger, because I'm younger and I'll spend more years in jail. So therefore, 50-50 on the gross. And again, as I point out in the union bargaining, splitting the difference, but what the difference is already depends on what the previous suggestions were, and obviously if I expect to split the difference, then I as the union want to make a high demand, and you as the employer want to make a low offer in order to the splitting the difference will come out closer to what you want. So all of these, it seems to me, although it's hard to formalize, are actually useful ways of thinking about how bargaining actually happens. And I actually have a article which I think I put as an optional reading that you might find interesting, in which I try to make profound statements about the nature of an orderly society, arguing that they ultimately come out of shelling points in an odd kind of way. You are not required to read it, but I thought it was interesting, so I passed it on to you. All right, another bit of game theory work that's actually quite interesting is experimental game theory, using not people but computers, or people and computers. And this has to do with prisoner's dilemma. And we talked about the question of repeated prisoner's dilemma, which in a way describes the real world, where each of us has a chance to cheat other people, but it may be known, and that'll affect whether they trust us next time and so forth. And so what Axelrod did was to set up a tournament in which the players submitted computer programs, and the program played prisoner's dilemma. So the program was, you basically, in effect, had program A versus program B play 100 rounds of Prisoner's Dilemma. Then program A went and played program C 100 rounds, and B went and played program D, and so forth, with sort of random matching up. And you kept track of the winnings. And the question was, what strategy, as defined by the program for playing it, resulted in average in doing best? So it's a very simple strategy. The two simplest strategies are never cheat and always cheat. All right, never cheat. You're an honest program. You never betray the other prisoner. Always cheat. You say, well, look, I've read this literature. We know that the rational thing to do is to cheat in a prisoner's dilemma, so cut out the middleman. Let's always cheat. And it turned out that in the initial plays, the one that won was a very simple program called Tit for Tat. And what Tit for Tat does was to cooperate on the first round. On any future round, if the opponent has cheated on that round, Tit for Tat cheats on the next round. That is, betrays. And then goes back to cooperating. So that it is punishing, as it were, but not punishing infinitely. And it turned out that at least in the version of the tournament I described, that was the most successful, even though some people had much more elaborate ones in which you tried to figure out from a series of from what the other one had done in his last 15 plays what you should do. He later expanded it to have an evolutionary system in which any strategies that did well in the first round of the tournament, you got multiple copies of them in the second round. And strategies that did badly either got eliminated entirely or you had fewer copies. And that matters because, of course, how well a strategy does probably depends on the other strategies you're playing against. If all the other players are nice guys, if all the other players are playing the strategy always cooperate, what's the obvious strategy that will maximize your return? Always cheat, always betray, that's right. And also, if everybody else is always betraying, you should always betray, incidentally. But if other people are doing tit for tat, now never cheating works very well. The only trouble is there'll be some people who aren't doing tit for tat who will succeed in exploiting your always cooperate strategy. Book is The Evolution of Cooperation, but it was an interesting, different approach to doing game theory, not as sort of mathematical theory, but as actually setting these things up and playing in the real world and seeing what happens. Other issues that I just wanted to touch on, but that are really part of it, are threats, bluffs, commitment strategies. A threat is something where I say, I'll do something that hurts you, even though it's not in my interest, in order that to keep me from doing that, you'll do what I want. Bluff, sort of similarly, and commitment strategies are when you actually restrict your alternatives in a way that makes you better off because the other guy knows they're restricted and the restriction helps you. That's the kid who gets sufficiently angry that she's going to throw a tantrum if you put her to bed, whether or not it's in her interest to do so. And nuisance suit is one possibility, the one I have. It looks on that one as though the defendant ought to offer an out-of-court settlement. For how much isn't clear. The going to court is going to cost the defendant $150,000, and it's going to cost the plaintiff on net $50,000. because the plaintiff on average will make $50,000, spend $100,000. So it's a bilateral monopoly problem. That is to say, if you really believe that the plaintiff is going to go through with it, you ought to buy him off for any price below $150,000. He'll accept any price above $50,000. On the other hand, you can see why it might be even better if the defendant can somehow commit itself not to settle. Now the plaintiff drops the suit because on average they're losing $50,000 by suing. Airline hijacking, obvious case. It was obvious even before 9/11 what the logic was, and of course 9/11 changed it by suggesting that doing what they told you might not get you out alive after all. And when is a commitment strategy believable? You could imagine a criminal who says, I'll never plea bargain. Why does he say that? Because that makes it more expensive to convict him, and making it more expensive to convict him means he hopes that the DA will go after someone else instead. But of course, the DA says, that's what you say, but when you've got the electric chair staring you in the face, you're going to change your mind, and you're going to agree to cop a plea. I don't know, have I discussed the sense in which plea bargaining is a prisoner's dilemma? I don't know if I discussed that in this class or not. It's an interesting argument. Bill Landis, I think, first made it, but it's pretty. It looks on the face of it as though plea bargaining helps defendants. All right, it looks like it's being soft on criminals, and it sometimes. I assume all of you know that most criminal cases never get tried. Right, that which means that most confessed criminals we have no reason to believe are guilty. That's an odd way of putting it, but if somebody says, look, if your lawyer says, look, there's one chance in four, they can get you put away for life, because although you didn't do it, and I believe you didn't do it, nonetheless, there's enough evidence they might persuade a jury, but they're willing to settle for time served plus 6 months if you'll plead to a much lesser thing. You may well be willing to do that even though you know you're innocent, because it's profitable. Depending on your reputational costs, of course, but you could be. But anyway, so plea bargaining looks like it helps the criminal because the criminal obviously would only accept the offer if, on average, he thought it was better than what happened if he goes to trial. The reason it's not clear that that's true is that prosecutors have limited resources. And every time I cop a plea, that frees up more of their lawyers and investigators to go after you. So it is true that the plea bargain deal I accept, I regard as better than going to trial. But that's better than going to trial in a system where 90% of the other defendants are copping pleas, which may be much worse than going to trial would be if you had to try all of us and therefore had your resources stretched much thinner. So it's a prisoner's dilemma in the sense that arguably all the prisoners would be better off if all of them refused to plea bargain. And yet each prisoner is better off plea bargaining. All right?
Well, wouldn't you bypass that by just plea bargaining with certain other defendants? For instance, if there's a crime where there's a conspiracy, instead of going to each and every one of them, you just go to a selected few, or maybe just one, and plea bargain with them, and make such a good deal that all
yes.
the others get.
This is otherwise known as suborning perjury. In fact, though not in law. Yeah, I mean, I happen to know somebody who ended up being in jail for a short while for something he hadn't done, and his claim, at least, was that he was told, he was put in a cell with a man who was accused of a much more serious crime. He was told, I guess by his lawyer, that if by any unlikely chance that man had confessed to that crime to him in the cell, the prosecuting authorities would look very, very charitably upon the charges against him. He chose not to. But yeah, no, that's clearly a further element. But I guess I don't really think of that as plea bargaining. It may legally be the same thing, but that's the case of saying if you give us evidence against the other parties, and insofar as it's really evidence, it's perfectly legitimate. The problem arises when it's testimony, and as I say, you have an incentive to commit perjury if people tell you we won't put you in jail if you say the right things. But anyway, but the point I was making was only that it does have the structure of prisoners of a many player prisoner's dilemma, which is itself sort of interesting. Very brief review: the basic problem is strategic behavior. We want ways of abstractly representing games so we can think about games in general, not just about this game or that game. One such method for a sequential game, a game where I move, then you move, then I move, then you move, is a decision tree that doesn't work for the kind of game where I don't know what you've done until I've made my choice, and you don't know what I've done until you've made your choice, where you're effectively moving simultaneously, and it doesn't work if there are commitment strategies, because now you can't unravel from one end, as it were, because people will arrange not to do what they would do. Strategy matrix is a way of representing all games, but it may or may not be useful for a particular game because the number of possible strategies is typically enormously large, since a strategy is not just a move but a full description of what you will do in every situation. Solution concept, subgame perfect equilibrium is what you use for the decision tree. Dominance is the prisoner's dilemma case, where one action is better whatever the other person does, which is not very interesting but simple. Von Neumann offered a way of solving any two-player fixed-sum game. Nash provided a way of defining a solution for a many-player game, provided that you had a clear definition of what strategies were, and provided that the players never cooperated, that I never took account of how you would change your strategy if I changed mine. And then von Neumann, I briefly summarized his attempt to solve games. I've done this already. I'm not going to go through it again. I think we've already done all. This is just a summary of the stuff, and I'm going to just zip through it because I've just done it, and go to my conclusion, and then go on to talk about the insurance stuff. So the conclusion, my view at least, not everybody would agree with it, is that game theory is helpful as a way of thinking. It's a way of sort of looking at certain kinds of situations and problems, such as in the subgame perfect one, in the case where you can say, well, look, when he gets to that point, what will he do? Ha! Now I know what he's going to do. Now I can figure out what I do at the point before. That's a useful way of thinking. You might have come up with it without studying game theory, but game theory does sort of point you in that direction. Thinking about commitment strategies. If you realize that one of your options is to tie your hands, and understand why in some situations having your hands tied is an advantage, because the other guy knows that with your hands tied you can't do what he wants you to do, therefore there's no point in his doing what was supposed to make you do it, and since you didn't want to do it except when he made you do it, etc. Right. Simple enough logic. Prisoner's dilemmas, more generally market failures, situations where individual rationality doesn't give you group rationality, how to avoid them. That's important in a whole bunch of contexts. In particular, if you're setting up a contract, you want to avoid creating situations where it's in each person's interest to do something that makes both of them worse off. And if you're designing a firm, you want to avoid situations where in the interest of your employees to do things that make the firm as a whole worse off. And Nash equilibrium and shelling points. And mixed strategies, which are the case where you can imagine some cases, as in paper, stone, scissors, where you might deliberately randomize. Because if you don't deliberately randomize, the other person might predict what you're going to do and act against it. Whereas if you do deliberately randomize, you can set it up where he couldn't possibly, however good his spies are, he doesn't know what the die roll is going to be. All right. So that's sometimes a useful way of doing things. On the other hand, in my view at least, game theory does not provide a rigorous answer either to the general question of what you as a player in a game should do, or of the more general question of what you people will do. That game theory appeals to economists because it looks like, it turns out if you do economics seriously, that a lot of economics consists of clever ways of avoiding strategic problems, of clever ways of structuring the analysis of the economy so that it looks like a single person playing against nature. If you think about perfect competition as the standard example, every firm is so small they don't affect the price, so they can take the price as a given rather than look at the other human beings who are acting in that system. Once you go beyond that, economists run into real problems. Game theory looks like the saving solution to letting us analyze strategic behavior, which is what oligopoly, for example, gets you into. But in my view, it never really does it with the kind of mathematical rigor people want for some of the reasons that hopefully have come through in this discussion. All right, before I go on from game theory to insurance, are there questions about what we've done so far? Insurance. we start out with something that is misnamed risk aversion. And it is the observed pattern that a lot of people would rather pay $1,000 than have one chance in 1,000 of paying $1,000,000. Which is why when you have $1 million house, you are willing to pay $1,000 a year to insure against fire, even though you believe that the chance of the house burning down is only 1 in 1,000 each year. All right? That's just an observation about human behavior. And one of the puzzles we'll be discussing is why do we act that way? Second topic, which we're going to be getting into shortly, is moral hazard. Moral is a confusing word here. It has nothing to do with moral philosophy. It's the, I think, coming out of an older sense in which moral really meant psychological. There's a quote from Napoleon, I think, that in war, the moral is to the physical as 3 to 1. I think that's the quote. And he didn't mean acting morally. He meant issues of how you make the enemy want to run away as opposed to how you actually move your troops around, or how you make your soldiers not run away would be, in his sense, a moral, almost like our word morale, though it's not quite the same. And the moral hazard in insurance is the fact that just as I explained in the other class, which doesn't help you very much, lots of problems are jointly caused. That is to say, how likely my building is to burn down depends partly on whether there's a lightning storm, but it also depends partly on how careful I was to make sure that the wires were insulated and that there were screens in front of the fireplaces and that my employees didn't work inside the building and so forth. So my house burning down is partly a random event, partly an event controlled by me. The more insurance I have, the less incentive I have to prevent the fire. So even though I'd rather my house or factory not burn down, we would like me to take precautions as long as the cost of the precaution is less than the savings, but I will take precautions only if the cost of the precaution is less than the savings to me, and if that building is insured, the savings to me are only part of the value of the house or the factory. Adverse selection is the third issue we'll be looking at. And I like to describe that as you are selling life insurance and somebody comes running into your office and says, I want $1,000,000 in life insurance right now. What is your response? Because you're a hard-hearted person. Why won't you sell him this life insurance that he's willing to pay you your ordinary life insurance rates, whatever they are, even more than your ordinary life insurance rates? Why don't you sell to him?
It seems like he has some information that is not available to me.
Yes, you suspect he knows something you don't about the fact that he was just caught having an affair with the local capo's mistress or some other hazard, or just had a bad diagnosis from his doctor or some other activity hazardous to his health. Isn't that true of everybody who buys insurance of any sort? That after all, the fact that you buy fire insurance on your house is some evidence that whatever information you have suggests the house is going to burn down. If we imagine two people otherwise identical, one of whom happens to know that his son smokes in bed and he can't get him to stop and he's very careless, and the other one doesn't have any such evidence, the first one is somewhat more likely to buy fire insurance than the second. So therefore, to some degree, buying the insurance is always a signal that you're at bad risk. So we then have to think about, but of course the problem with that is that the more buying insurance is a signal you're a bad risk, the higher the price the insurance company will pay for people who buy insurance. They aren't interested in the risk for everybody, they're interested in the risk for people who buy insurance. But the higher the price they charge, the worse deal it is for the good risks, and therefore the more they're selected out. And this is what's called adverse selection. So let's start out with risk aversion. And the mechanics of insurance is basically that you can reduce risk by pooling it. You don't reduce loss by pooling it. On average, the insurance company loses the sum of what all of the insured would have lost. But the difference is that each insured has a small chance of a large loss, whereas the insurance company, given the laws of averages, has a large chance of a fairly predictable loss. Yeah, a million of you, they can predict that the cost will be just about 1,000 houses burning down each year, unless there's a war and somebody firebombs a city or some similar event happens. But then the question is, why do I care about risk? Why would I rather pay $1,000 with certainty than $1 million with one chance of 1,000? And the simple answer to that is what economists refer to as declining marginal utility of income. And it's a simple, intuitive idea. I don't think it's rigorously true. You can imagine cases where it's false, but it's what you'd expect. And that is that if you imagine you start out having an income of $80,000 a year, and somebody says, here's this gamble you can take. If things go well, you'll make $120,000 a year. If they go badly, you'll make $40,000 a year. 50-50 chance. Why do you reject that gamble? Why do most of us reject that gamble? Well, not all of us. What?
Is yep. it because you're risk averse?
The fact you reject that gamble means you're risk averse. Why? Risk averse is just a label. Yep.
Because the amount
you might be somebody who likes jumping out of airplanes with a parachute and still reject the gamble. So risk aversion is a misleading term. Because it isn't really that you don't like the feeling of risk. It's something different than that. Yep.
The amount of utility that you would gain from winning the $40,000 is less than the amount of utility you would lose.
And why do you expect that to be the case? I say it isn't rigorous, but why does it seem plausible that that's the case?
Well, it's like each additional dollar of income, your utility is...
Why?
You're not worried about other things. So having just more disposable income makes you buy more toys or something like that. But if you're down to $40,000, maybe you can't pay your mortgage.
Put it differently. This is, I think I assure you know why it's not rigorous. Let me take what looks like a rigorous proof. Imagine that I'm starting at zero, and there are a list of things that I could buy, and they vary in their value per dollar. All right, water has a really high value per dollar because it costs hardly anything. Without it, I die in a couple of days. So if all I got is 50 cents, I use that to buy water. Now, food has a pretty high value to dollar too, even though not as high as water. It's more expensive and you can last longer without it. So when I'm up to $500 a year, I spend all of that on food. Well, you know, living out in the cold isn't much fun. So as my income goes higher, I now say I've got water, I've got food. It's true, I'd like wine and Diet Coke and other things, but next priority is a place to shelter and a bed to sleep on and so forth. So if you think of sort of a list of goods ranked by how much value per dollar you get, at low incomes you're buying the ones with very high value per dollar, and as your income goes up you're going down that list to the less and less important ones. Now it's not a perfect argument because implicitly it thinks of everything as separable. But of course the value of one thing may depend on what else you have. So that to take the simple example, if you're buying tires for your car, the extra value of the fourth tire is higher than that of the first, second, and third. Because that's a case where you need the first three for the... Right. But it does seem as sort of a generally plausible idea in most situations that as your income goes on, you're first buying the most important, then the somewhat less important, then the somewhat less important, and so on. And I think that's the intuition that really underlies this idea of declining marginal utility. And given that, you then say, sure, but if I went from $80,000 down to $40,000, I'd be giving up on things really important to me. I couldn't send my kid to college. We'd never be able to go out to a restaurant. We could eat some meat, but you know, have a fair number of beans and not much steak. $80,000 to $120,000 would sort of be nice to vacation in Paris, and I would sort of like to have a Mercedes instead of a Ford, but none of those aren't very valuable gains. So it therefore seems plausible that most people will act that way. So therefore, if you think about it in terms of an uncertain future, we would say that I would like to transfer money between the future where my house didn't burn down and therefore had a fair amount of money, and the future where it did burn down and I was therefore poor, and I, in effect, am using the insurance company to transfer money between those alternative futures. From me when I'm rich to me when I'm poor, so to speak. And that's a simple, I think, plausible explanation. Why do I say risk aversion is a misleading term? Because I'm really making a statement not about risk, but about money. That, as I said, this might be the same person who enjoys jumping out of airplanes with a parachute because he likes the thrill. And imagine that we're thinking not in terms of money, but in terms of years of life. So take the case that I have here, where I get the bad news that I've got a lethal disease, but the doctor says, you've got a chance. It's a slow-killing disease. If you do nothing, you've got 15 years. On the other hand, there is this operation. And the good news is that if the operation is successful, you'll live for 30 years. The bad news is that half the time the operation fails, and that's the end of the story. Right? You don't come out of the operating room alive. And the question is, you might say, well, if I'm risk-averse, I should prefer a certainty of 15 years to a 50% chance of 30 years. But let us suppose that, in fact, what I've always really wanted to do is to have and bring up children. I've found the perfect woman. She's willing to consent not only to marry me, to bear my children. In 30 years, we can produce children. We can bring them up. We can get them to the point where they can support themselves. 15 years, we can't. So therefore, if I'm going to live 15 years, I'm going to say to the woman, I'm sorry, it would have been a nice future, but I got this bad news from my doctor. If I'm going to live 30 years, go ahead with my previous plans. I may not like it, but I take the operation. Same person insures his house against fire. What's going on? He has declining marginal utility of income, but increasing marginal utility of years of life. And there's no inconsistency because you can't buy a year with a dollar, so there's no particular reason why the pattern of value of the one has to be the same as the other. They aren't exchangeable between each other. So that's why they say, I dislike the term risk aversion, because it makes it sound as though it's an attitude to risk, whereas in fact it's an attitude to money and the things you can buy with money, and which wouldn't have to apply to other things that you might be able to do. Let me stop just for a moment. Are there people who find that puzzling and want further explanation, discussion of it or not? This is one of the things you won't get in other economics courses, probably, because everybody likes that term risk aversion. They don't think about what it really means. All right, moral hazard. I have a $10 million factory. I'm worried about fire. And there is a precaution I could take that would cost $10,000 and reduce the risk of fire by 1%. And the reducing it by 1% is worth $100,000 to me, so the precaution only costs $10,000, I'll take it. Costs anything less than $100,000, I'll take it. Costs more than $100,000, I won't take it. And speaking as a stockholder in your company, I don't want you to take it, because you're going to be making me poorer on average if you spend more to prevent the risk than the risk actually costs. Now suppose that I have insured the factory for $9 million. How cheap does that same precaution have to be before I'm willing to take it? Precaution reduces the chance of losing a $10 million factory by 1%, so it saves me on average $100,000. Sorry, it saves an average $100,000. How cheap does the precaution have to be if 90 of those 100,000 are the insurance company's money and not mine? How much do I lose when the factory burns down? I lose $1 million. How much am I willing to spend to avoid one chance in 100? Assume I'm risk neutral for a moment. This is a firm, not an individual. What's 1% of a million? What? 10,000. What? 10,000. 1% of a million is 10,000. Therefore, if any precaution that costs less than 10,000 that has this characteristic, I'll take, but any precaution between 10,000 and 100,000, in a certain sense, I ought to take, considering both my interest and the insurance company's interest, but in fact, I won't. All right? The result of this is not that insurance companies are poor, because the insurance company knows about moral hazard. So the insurance company says, wait a minute. When we were deciding how much to charge you for insurance, we started out on the theory that you had a 5% chance of burning down. Sounds pretty high, but suppose it's 5%. But we've rethought that, because it's true that for the last 20 years, factories like yours that were uninsured only burned down 1 year out of 20. But factories like yours that were insured for 90% of their value, they burned down 2 years out of 20 because people weren't as careful and didn't take as many precautions. So we're therefore going to charge you $1 million a year for your insurance, not $500,000 for your insurance. So the insurance company is fine. They're insuring a risk at a fair cost. Actually, they'll charge you more than $500,000 because they got to pay salaries and rent and stuff, but we'll ignore that at this point. However, notice that what you're now getting is a 10% chance of $1 million risk plus a certainty of $1 million a year payment, where before you had a 5% chance of a $10 million risk. And a little bit of arithmetic should tell you that on average you're now worse off than you were before. So the insurance has on net cost you because it induced you to behave in a way that resulted in your not taking cost-justified precautions, and although at this point that's a cost for the insurance company, ex ante, given that it goes into what they're going to charge you for insurance, it's really a cost for you. So that's the basic problem of moral hazard. So there's a net loss, and the net loss comes from my having too low an incentive to take precautions. What are the solutions to this problem? One of the solutions is the insurance company says, wait a minute, we've got a list of precautions that cost between $10,000 and $100,000, and we're going to have our inspector check every year and go down to the checklist and make sure you've taken all of them. If you haven't, we won't insure you. And if your factory burns down, we'll have a fire inspector look at it, and if it turns out the reason it burned down is that you were having a fireworks display inside it after you had promised us you wouldn't, sorry, we're not going to pay. All right. You can think of different variants of that. But basically, the insurance company can try to monitor the precautions you take and make their rate dependent on that. However, that only works for observable precautions. All right? One of the examples, which I ought to look into it, but I think I know what's going on, is if you go into the kind of garage that does car repair work, you will very often see a sign on the door which says customers may not go beyond this point. If you, in fact, go beyond this point, nobody will stop you, at least in my experience, even with the guy visible and you're talking with him while you do it. So my guess is that what's happening is the insurance company says you can't let customers in because we might be liable for them. Fine, we'll put up the sign, but the insurance company doesn't have anybody watching to enforce the rule. Now, they may also figure that if the sign is there, you'll lose when you sue. That I don't know about. But at least part of it, I suspect, is the insurance company wanting the car repair company to take certain precautions, which they don't, in fact, bother to take. But other cases, if you think about putting in a sprinkler system, they can make sure the sprinkler system is there. They can test it once a year and so forth. Again, they could also make the fire only cover, the insurance only cover if you took the precautions you had agreed to take, but that depends on their being able to tell somehow what happened. But there's another, in a sense, much simpler way of trying to reduce the problem, and that's to what's called coinsurance, which means insuring for less than the full value of the property. So instead of insuring for $9 million, they insure for $5 million. So they've gotten a good deal of your risk off, though not all of it. And now, if you're only insured for $5 million, what are the precautions you're willing to take? And what are the precautions you're not willing to take? Again, I'm going to assume for simplicity that every precaution reduces the chance of a fire by 1%. Sort of my stand. What? What?
$50,000?
You're going to willing to take precautions up to the $50,000 precaution. All right? Makes sense? Notice that this, in effect, reduces more than half the problem. This isn't obvious at first. But the problem comes from the difference between the cost of the precaution and the benefit. So if I fail to take a precaution, suppose they have a precaution that costs $11,000, saves $100,000. What's the net loss due to my failure to take that precaution? All right. How about a precaution that costs $25,000 and saves $100,000? What's the net loss due to my not taking that one? 75. How about a precaution that costs $80,000 and saves $100,000? What's the net loss due to my not taking that one?
20.
So notice that when you co-insure to half, when you're only insuring for $5 million, There are still precautions that I should take and not, and I'm not taking. But they're the ones where the net loss is relatively low. All right, expensive, not taking a precaution that's worth taking but is expensive loses you a little bit. It loses you $20,000 in this case. Not taking a precaution that's cheap and saves you money loses you a lot. So as you reduce the fraction of insurance, you are, as it were, eliminating the most serious inefficiencies, these ones, and only leaving the less serious ones. So that's a point I think that's not entirely obvious, but it's worth noticing, and that's why it may well be that you're better off at 50% than you would be at 80 or 90%. What happens, by the way, if the insurance company is so careless as to insure your factory for 110%? What happens to the probability that it will burn down then?
It
becomes very, very high indeed, right?
But if the smoking side, don't go away, pardon?
Yeah, right. So they say that's called co-insurance. Now, it means that you aren't getting rid of all of the risk, of course, so there is a downside to it. But it suggests that very often the right compromise is to get rid of some of the risk but keep enough risk so that you have an incentive to at least do the more important of the things necessary to prevent the risk. We now, however, have a real-world puzzle which tends to get omitted in these. And that is that it makes sense that the value of a dollar to you changes a lot between $20,000 a year and $200,000. But not much between $200,000 and $200,100. And yet, people often insure against small losses. People get service contracts on their washing machine. Even people who live in million-dollar houses get service contracts on their washing machines. Well, from the standpoint of somebody whose total assets, let's say, are $1 million, the having to have the washing machine repaired is a trivial change in income, so the dollars, if that does or doesn't happen, are of almost exactly the same value, and yet they've got to pay the insurance company enough to cover its salaries and stuff, so why do they do it? Similarly, people have medical insurance that covers routine checkups, as you would think on everything we've been saying, that medical insurance ought to be only for really expensive stuff, and not for the kind of stuff that happens routinely year by year, and so forth. So the question is, any guesses? Somebody was raising a hand. Why do we do these things? Are we just stupid? Is it just that the clever salesmen persuade us to buy the service contracts and when we're too foolish to realize that we're being taken advantage of? Or is there a better reason?
People don't have the time to worry about it. Don't want the hassle. Especially rich people having washing machine contracts or something like that. Don't want anybody.
Maybe. That's possible. I think I have a variant of that which I find more persuasive. But anybody? Yeah?
I think it hurts a lot more to have to pay $1 million, you know, possibly, than $10,000, definitely. It's like, you know for sure you have the $10,000 to pay for it, but
we're talking now about very small amounts. I understand why people insure against their houses burning down. The question is, why do you insure against having a $100 bill for fixing your washing machine? Why do you have insurance against paying $25 to repair your toaster? You can replace the damn thing for $30. Some people buy service contracts on their toasters. But even for the washing machine, it's maybe it's more than $100. But the question is, if it's small compared to your income, if it's small compared to the amount of money in your savings account, so that it doesn't represent a significant change in your lifestyle the way losing $1 million would, or even $100,000 for many people, $10,000 for some people, why are you willing to pay to reduce the risk when it's that kind of small risk? That's the puzzle.
Well, then it's on your own terms.
What do you mean?
Well, it seems like if you're paying $25 for a smaller appliance, is that you're paying it whenever you know you have it, where you know you have this disposable income, as opposed to sometime in the future.
But don't you think that most of the people...
We haven't gotten it at all for the toaster example.
Yeah. Don't you think that most of the people who buy these contracts, though not all, are people who have enough money in the bank so that they, in fact, are in no serious doubt that they can pay to have their washing machine? There's some people whom that's not true, obviously. But my guess would be that the sort of normal employed person in Silicon Valley is not going to hurt if he has to have his washing machine repaired. Yep.
Maybe you look at it as kind of... paying once, you need to pay a little more rather than paying for it twice.
How are you paying for it twice? You mean it might break down twice?
Breaks, you buy more.
Yeah, but the amount that you're going to have to pay for the insurance, presumably the people providing that service contract aren't aren't a charity, so they must be allowing for the possibility they may have to fix it twice in the price they charge you initially. I don't see why it's better to pay $50 now than to pay $20 now and then $20 later, which is what it is, because you've got to pay a little extra because it costs them something to operate there. Let me offer an entirely different explanation, which is that, in fact, this isn't really insurance, even though it looks like insurance. And I want to take a somewhat different case, and that's the case of a big company with many factories. And the basic logic of the argument so far says they shouldn't buy insurance. They can self-insure. They've got 1,000 factories. They're in different places. One factory burns down a year, two factories burn down a year. That's just going to average out just as if they had an insurance company. Yet they might. And one reason why they might has to do with their problem in getting precautions taken. Because suppose you're the manager in charge of that factory. And you believe that if you don't spend anything on fire prevention, there's a 3% chance of a fire. Or if you spend $100,000, you reduce it to 1% each year. Considering your position as an employee, and assuming for a moment that you're the one who's making the decision, I'm assuming that the company doesn't have good enough monitoring of you to figure out whether you're doing the right thing. All they see is there a fire and what's your bottom line look like? All right. How are you going to act in that case? You're not the company. You're not the stockholders. You're the employee. And you say, if I have a choice, strategy A, I'm going to be here for a few years. There's a very small chance it'll burn down, 3% a year. And my bottom line is going to be $100,000 better than the next guy. Strategy B, my bottom line isn't $100,000 better, but there's only a 1% chance of it burning down. What's a reasonable
behavior? You want to see the results up front, so they're not going to do anything.
What you're going to say is, if it burns down, it's true that burning down is going to cost the company $20 million, whatever. It's not going to cost me $20 million. All it'll cost me is my job. That's too bad. On the other hand, it's very unlikely to burn down. I'm only going to be managing for a few years. There's one chance in 10, one chance in 20. Probably won't happen. And there are 19 chances in 20 that I will get promoted with a good report because look how well I ran the company. I made them an extra $100,000 a year compared to my predecessor. And if it burns out on somebody else's watch, that's not my responsibility. So if you think about it in terms of the problem of a company controlling its own employees, you can see that there might be a serious issue of how do you make the employee act. Yes?
Isn't it also that you also look for something like an alternative to just the insurance? Instead of saying, I only have a choice to either spend $100,000 or keep the $100,000, why don't I insure privately? For instance,
the $100,000 isn't the insurance. The $100,000 is precautions.
Okay, for the precaution, why don't I look for a different alternative that's costing less than $100,000? And still makes me ahead of the other.
Well, you might, but all I'm saying is if when you found the best alternative available, the best alternative available costs $100,000 and reduces it by this amount, your employer would want you to buy that, assuming that the factory's worth enough so that it's worth $100,000 to reduce it by 2%. But you wouldn't want to, providing your employer isn't watching you very carefully. And the employer, knowing that, might say, Wait a minute. This moral hazard isn't a bug at all. It's a feature. Because what we're going to do is we're going to insure the factory for $8 or $9 million. And we're going to tell the insurance company, by the way, why don't you keep an eye on how it's being run? You are experts on preventing fire. That's all you do, basically. You're a fire insurance company. You're the ones who are going to tell us if our employee is messing up. And you have an incentive to have people whose job it is to figure out whether things are being run right. So let's take the argument here is that we call it moral hazard because we're implicitly assuming that the guy who owns the house or the factory is in the best position to prevent the fire. But if the company that owns the factory is not in the best position because it can't control its employees, transferring a good deal of the risk to the insurance company may actually be a gain. That's where I think of it as a case where moral hazard is a feature, not a bug. Well, let's think about the service contract. Sears knows a whole lot more about getting Sears washing machines fixed than I do. So if I don't have the contract with Sears, when it gets fixed, I've got to find a reliable repairman who maybe will cheat me. After all, I only get a washing machine fixed every once every 5 or 10 years. How much do I know about who to trust and how much it ought to cost? Sears gets a washing machine fixed every 2 days. So therefore, it may make sense to say, I'm going to transfer the responsibility for fixing the washing machine to Sears, because although it's true I then have less an incentive to take good care of the washing machine, they have a much, much higher incentive to get it fixed well at the lowest cost. After all, if it's not fixed well, they're going to have to fix it again because they've still got this contract on it. And that therefore what I'm really doing is, as I put it in the headline of this, putting the incentive where it does the most good. And I think that's a useful way of generalizing the moral hazard argument. The normal moral hazard argument starts out assuming the owner is the person who can best control the problem, therefore insurance reduces his incentive, therefore that's a cost. And you say, no, somebody can best reduce the problem. It might be the owner, it might be the seller, as in Sears' case. It might be an insurance company that specializes in fire insurance. And of course, you can also imagine the case where both parties can protect, where there are certain things where the insurance company can do a better job than you can, certain things where you can do a better job. What does co-insurance do? It means that the insurance company has an incentive to do those things it can do that have a big payoff, though not the ones with a small payoff. So to you, that's probably better than a system where one of you has all the incentive and the other none. Make sense? Not make sense? Still seeing a lot of neutral faces, yes.
So you're willing to pay the insurance premium because you're confident that Sears has the knowledge and ability to repair your washer?
The reason I think it will cost me less, and I'm not risk averse in this case because the sums are small compared to my income. And the reason I buy it is my conjecture is that the cost, on average, I will pay less to Sears for the repair contract than I would pay on average to repair people to repair the washer. And the reason I suspect that's true is that my guess is that Sears can do a much better job than I am of hiring people to fix their washers.
Okay.
Because they're experts. That's their business and one of their businesses.
What if you have the option of paying $25 for the insurance premium from Sears or paying $100 when it breaks to Sears to fix it? And does it change the...
That's an interesting question, and I guess the answer would be it changes it only if I say that Sears' incentives are now different. For example, in the case you just gave, Sears doesn't care whether it breaks again next month. Whereas if they have the service contract, they do care if it breaks again next month. And indeed, there's a further argument I haven't even made, and that is that Sears' willingness to, in effect, insure it is some evidence they think it's well made. This gets to a difference, it's a good story, which I want to tell you, and I think I probably have it later in the lecture, or maybe I don't. And this is my friend Ami Glazer, who's an economist at UC Irvine, probably still is. And Ami wanted to buy a used car. Famously difficult thing to do. And so Ami went to a used car dealer, and he found a car that was about the kind of car he wanted at a reasonable price. He said, look, if I pay you an extra $100, will you give me a 1-year warranty on this car? And the dealer said, no. That was whatever he thought was a reasonable price. So Ami went off to the next dealer. Eventually he finds the dealer who says, yep, I'll sell you the car you want, price that I've said, $100 I'll give you a 1-year warranty. And Ami said, fine, I'll take the car, I don't want the warranty. All right, you see what he's doing? Ami's a clever guy, I like him. I haven't seen him for a long time, unfortunately. So anyways, the argument I'm really making is that the standard economic treatment of insurance is too narrow. It covers one reason, namely risk aversion, but it doesn't cover the fact that sometimes, instead of risk aversion in spite of moral hazard, sometimes the reason is in order to generate what looks like moral hazard, i.e. to shift the incentive to some other person who better than the owner can control the cost, for whatever reason. Let's think about health insurance. Health insurance, if the purpose is risk spreading, ought to consist of a big deductible, because that just means you'll pay up to the deductible, and which means that I pay for all the minor things, which gives me an incentive to keep the costs down, not to visit the doctor unless it's really worth doing, but on the other hand, cover almost 100% of my cancer treatment, my heart transplant, the things that could bankrupt me or come close to bankrupting me. So that's not the way we observe it. Now, one reason we don't observe it that way is that a lot of health insurance is employer-provided. That is a way of avoiding taxes because you're paying with pre-tax, not post-tax dollars, and that gives an incentive to do more, which is to some extent reduced by the fact that some medical expenses are deductible on your taxes, but only if they go above a certain level. So for small expenses, there's a tax incentive to have small expenses covered by insurance, even though there's no risk aversion incentive. But a different possible reason, I don't know if it's the right reason or not, is the idea that just as with Sears, repairing me requires expertise too, and the insurance company, if I'm going to be insured with them for a while, don't want me to come back to the same doctor next month, so they want to find doctors who'll do a good job. Maybe they can do a better job negotiating with the doctors. So I'm not sure that's the right explanation. I have another one of my friends, Robin Hansen, who's a very interesting guy now teaching at George Mason. And he came up with a neat scheme for how you do, for health, basically. And my scheme, because one of the basic problems in the medical field is how do I figure out what treatments I ought to buy, what doctors to trust, and so forth. It'd be nice to have an expert doing that for me, but how do you get an expert I can trust in it? Robin's system goes as follows. First, I decide how much my life is worth. And that's an odd way of putting it, but I can easily enough say, all right, if this treatment reduces the chance of my dying tomorrow by 1%, what's the highest price that I'm willing to pay for that? Not infinite, right? We do accept risks at some cost. And suppose I decide my life is worth $10 million. I then go to a company and I buy $10 million of life insurance. And this is a rather special life insurance company, because having sold me $10 million of life insurance, they then make all my future medical decisions and pay for them. Why? Because I've just transferred the risk of my life from me to them. It's their $10 million they're trying to save, and they're willing to pay to save their $10 million. And they now have a $10 million incentive to keep me alive. Now, there is, of course, a small problem, and that is I don't actually want $10 million worth of life insurance. All right? That's all right. I now find another company which is in the negative life insurance business, and I sell my life insurance policy to them. They won't give me as much as I'm paying the first one, because the first one's got to cover my medical expenses as well, but I've now rearranged the incentives so that company one has a $10 million incentive to keep me alive. Be nice if we could insure against disability and other things as well. I'm just taking the simple version where all I care about is alive or dead, not whether I'm living in pain. So company one now has the full incentive, and I don't have to actually get the risk arrangement I don't want, namely getting $10 million when I'm dead and can't enjoy it. I sell that off to the other company. So that's Robin's solution. There are various practical problems I won't go into, but it's a neat idea. Yes?
I was going to say, isn't the problem that the fact that at some point they're going to cut their losses and say, well, you get cancer, it's not worth it.
That's what you want them to do. You may not feel that way at the time, but when you're buying the, when you made the decision that your life is worth $10 million, you decide that yourself. That was a decision about how much cost you wanted them to be willing to bear for a given reduction. You know, in the last 3 months, it may be hard to say, look, it's going to cost $1 million to get another 3 months, not worth it. But looking at it in advance, that's probably the decision you want to make. I've seen it argued, I'm not sure if it's true, that one reason why medical care is so expensive in the U.S. is that we spend huge amounts of money on the last couple of months of life. And that doesn't buy us very much. It's not a very pleasant couple of months, but it's very, very hard to say, just, you know, turn off the switch and let the guy die. All right, adverse selection. It was the guy running into the insurance company's office. The classic article on this was called The Market for Lemons. The basic assumption is you have a used car, which if it's in good condition is worth $10,000 to the buyer and $8,000 to the seller, which is why the seller is willing to sell. A lemon, however, is worth $5,000 to the owner, $5,000 to a buyer, $4,000 to the seller. Half the cars are cream puffs and half are lemons. First approximation, we say, well, look, car's got a 50% chance of being a cream puff, 50% chance of a lemon, so therefore I'm willing to offer anything up to $7,500. That's the average between cream puff and lemon. The problem with that, what happens in that case? Suppose buyers are willing to offer $7,000 for cars, what cars sell? Only lemons, right? Cream pump is worth $8,000 to the seller. He'd like to get a new car, but this car is running just fine. So unless he can get a good price for it, he's not going to sell. So all the cars are seller lemons. Given that, you as a buyer say, oops, I made a mistake. I ought to only be willing to offer up to $5,000 because although it's true that half the cars offered for sale are cream puffs, all of the cars that will actually accept my offers are lemons, and those are all that matter to me. And the result of that is the cream puffs don't sell. Even though the cream puff is worth more to the buyer than to the seller because the seller knows it's the cream puff and the buyer doesn't, you get adverse selection driving the cream puffs out of the market. And how might you avoid the problem? This is what we refer to as asymmetric information. One way is to make the information symmetric by having a mechanic inspect the car. If that's enough to tell me if it's a lemon, then we're fine. If it's a lemon, I pay a lemon price for it. Cream puff, I pay a cream puff price. We're happy either way. Another possibility would be that the seller insures the car. That's offering evidence that it's a cream puff because he says if it breaks down in the first year, I'll pay for having it fixed. What problems does that raise? I'll leave you to think about that question. Quite often, when you're trying to figure out how to do something, how to set up a law, the structure of it is, here's a problem. Here's a solution to this problem. Here's the problem the solution raises. Here's a solution to that problem. Here's the problem that solution raises. Which I find at least a useful way of thinking things through often, trying to decide what you want to do. All right, I think we're done. We can all go off until next Tuesday. I do hope you're reading the book. I think that my presentation is not identical to the books, but I think the book has stuff of value to give as well.